Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Yevamos Daf Pei Tes. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our homepage. If you're already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief formatted introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf Gemara before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins seven lines from the top of Daf Pei Tes. Before we begin the actual shiur, let us glance at the side where we have our nosei, our topic heading, written in the margin. Nosei Hesber, we're going to explain Dinei HaMishnah, different laws that were mentioned in the Mishnah. Lama Ein Law, why is it that a woman who was married, whose husband went abroad and she received a word from through a singular witness that the husband was dead, she went and married someone else, and then the husband came back, so the Mishnah said that she must leave both men, the original husband and the new husband, and she loses all of the provisions that a married woman receives upon marriage. And we call that she loses her ksuba rights. And included in the provisions, there's the written ksuba marriage document, which provides for a sum of money that she is entitled to receive. And in the event that a regular woman, that is divorced or is widowed, and she will, in our case, she loses that, and she loses peiros, mizonos, and blos. These are terms that we've mentioned numerous times in past shiurim as to what they are. For our purposes, they're different provisions that normal legal type marriage the woman receives, not so in our case. So our Gemara, Ein Lo Ksuba. The Gemara explains, "My time otokinu lo rabbonon ksuba." Why, in general, have the rabbonon established tokinu is to provide a legal provision for a woman to receive a ksuba? That's again the financial guarantees afforded to a woman who marries. So why were those established in the first place? Kidei shelo te kalobein of lotzia, so that it would not be easy for a husband to divorce his wife. He's always, if he becomes dissatisfied with his wife, so what would stop a man from simply throwing her out? The answer to that is that which the Chachamim have provided. We'll call it the sensitivity of our sages for the welfare of the woman, that it shouldn't be so easy for him to get rid of her. So he'll have to pay money, and a lot of money at that. That's the ksuba. So in our case, though, where the woman had married a second man and the original husband came back, ha tehei kalobeinov lotzia. Here we're actually interested in him releasing her as quickly as possible. So in order to do that, we remove the financial block that would have hindered or deterred him from divorcing her by saying, if you divorce her, so you don't have to pay any money. Ein lo peiros velo mizonos velo blos. She loses also these aspects, the peiros, mizonos, and blos. Tanai ksuba kiksuba domi. The same standard that we applied to the ksuba, we applied to the additional non-written ksuba provisions. These are non-written provisions that are legally instituted on behalf of the woman. So in this case where there was a mistaken marriage to the second man and we want her to leave both men, so we say she loses those provisions, the peiros, mizonos, and blos. Notla mizeh o mizeh tachzir. Blos, that we had mentioned just the line before, was quoted in the Mishnah. She is a reference to suits of clothing that she brought into the marriage, articles of clothing that the husband wore while they were married. if they are worn out, whereas when they be after the husband wears them in a regular case of divorce, she would get the worn out suits in return. Not so in our situation of the woman who married a second man on based on the testimony of a singular witness that the original husband died, so she doesn't get those suits of clothing in return. Blows her the worn out clothing that the husband had used. And if she took them, not Klomizel, if she took them, those worn out suits from the original husband and from the second husband, Tachsir, the Mishnah says she has to give them back. Pshita, well, isn't that obvious? Isn't it obvious once you tell me that she's not supposed to receive it, if she does take them, she has to give it back? So the Gemara answers, why was it necessary for the Mishnah to spell that point out? Mahu detema. I would have thought kevan detafsa lo mafkino mino, that even though she's initially not supposed to receive it, but if she grabbed them, and bear in mind she's grabbing something that in a regular marriage situation she is in fact entitled to. So in our case, since she grabbed them, maybe we wouldn't go so far as to remove them from her, to return them, to give them to the men. Komashmlon, we in fact do that. We take a proactive role in removing the suits that she wrongfully took. Havlad Mamzer. The Mishnah reported that the child born is an illegitimate child. Before we begin our sukya, we glance at the side. We have a nosei. The topic heading reads, Ein Tormin Min HaTomei Al HaTohar. The Gemara, we should point out, starts off in a seemingly unrelated fashion, unrelated to our Mishnah. And when you see this kind of thing throughout the Shas, you have to wonder what's the discussion taking place for. And inevitably, you will find in the course of the discussion some reference, let's say, proof or question to the point under discussion is raised from our Mishnah. So that we start off with a discussion that seems to be unrelated, but in the course of the Gemara, and here we're going to have to wait a while. We'll see when we get to Amud Beis where there is a quote from our Mishnah. So in the meantime, we are reading the topic heading on the side, Ein Tormin Min HaTomei Al HaTohar. In the tithing process, a man has a field and produce is grown in his field in the land of Israel. There are several tithes that a person is expected to remove. One of them is called truma. That's the tithe of produce one gives to a kohen. Truma is sensitive to the laws of ritual impurity. So if a person has a section of his harvest that became defiled and he hasn't tithed it yet, we don't want him removing from the defiled fruits, defiled produce, a tithe to exempt the pure, undefiled section of his harvest. So we say, Ein tormin min HaTomei Al HaTohar. Ve'im also kein, if he did this. Now, by doing that, what you've created is truma that's tomei. You'll have truma tomei. Now, if he did that, b'mezid lo osa v'lo klum, if he did so deliberately, so the action is considered null and void. It's nothing. Lo osa v'lo klum. The Gemara will spend time in explaining that idea of what does that mean, lo osa velo klum. We'll see in the Gemara two opinions. Those of, and the names are underlined, you can see Rav Chista and number two, Rav Nosson, Rav Yoshia, explaining what is the intent of the source that says that a deliberate tithing from the defiled to exempt the undefiled is considered of no effect. So now, let's turn to the Gemara text. Tanan Hossam, a Tanaic source that you see in Maseches Trumos and other places, Ein tormin min atome ala tohor. One is not to tithe from that which is defiled to exempt that which is undefiled. If one were to do that, so you're causing a loss to the Kohen, because a Kohen will not be able to eat the defiled tithe. V'im toram b'shogeg trumoso trum. If he did so, but unknowingly. So the tithe is a good tithe. It's considered effective. And if he did so b'mezid lo osa v'lo klum. If he did so knowing that it was defiled, he did so deliberately, so his action is of no value, of no consequence. My lo osa v'lo klum. To what extent do we say that it's of no value? Omer of Chista, lo osa v'lo klum kol ikir. It's as if he did nothing. Kol ikir means whatsoever. De'afilo ahi griva hader l'tivle. Even that griva, that the measure. Griva is a word that represents a very small measure. Truma is a tithe that percentage-wise can be negligible. So it's even that small amount that he dedicated as truma reverts to its untithed status. So that nothing whatsoever, not only has the tohor section of his crops not been tithed, but even the amount that he separated and declared as truma, even that does not take hold. Reb Noson Reboshia Omar, lo osav lo klum, lesakin es hashirayim. We say that his tithing action, when he declared that small amount of tomei produce as truma, so it's ineffective in remedying, in exempting the tohor crops, and they will need to be dealt with separately. So it's ineffective in being mesakein es hashirayim, to literally to fix the balance of the crops. Avol truma have, but the amount that he had separated and declared as truma, it becomes truma. He'll then have to tithe again from the tohar, but that which he has separated is considered truma, and as such, so it has truma restrictions, has truma identity, even though it in fact is tamei. A kohen will not be able to eat from it. The procedure with truma tamei is it is burnt, and one can benefit from the fuel aspect of it. Rav Chista lo omak Rav Noson bar Rav Yoshia. Rav Chista, who said what he did, did not say the explanation of Rav Noson. The Amris Havi Truma were fearful that if we allow the tithing that he did to be declared as Truma, Zimnin de Posha Velo Mafrish. At times people will be negligent, Posha has to be negligent, and won't do the necessary next tithing from the Tohar produce. Rashi adds in his commentary a foreshadowing of that which the Gemara will deal with later, a very important, major topic. So let's take a look at Rashi about halfway down. Dilma Posha, we're afraid that if we allow the tithe that he did, like Reb Noson said, it itself is considered truma, he'll be negligent for lo hader mafrish min hatohar, and he won't do the subsequent re-tithing from the tohar produce. Ulekamen porach, later the Gemara will ask, kevan de midoraisa truma hi, since on a strictly Torah level, in other words, on a level that's pre-rabbinic intervention, one who tithes from the defiled to exempt the other pure crops, it actually is considered an effective tithing. On a Torah level, then the amount that he separated as truma certainly is considered truma. Midikotani, and we can see this from the source that we read, it said Bishogeg Truma so truma. If he did so unwittingly, the tithing is in fact effective. So it must be that tithing from that which is defiled does not a priori exempt or prevent it from being considered truma. So hechi mafkainu lo mikidushasa mishum Dilma Pasha, how is it that the Rabbanan can move in and take something that on a Torah level is considered a tithe and declare it something else, declare it tevel, consider it as untithed? The Torah says it's a tithe. What power do the Rabbanan have to come in and say it's not a tithe? Right, that's a question that we'll be dealing with later. However, in the meantime, the Gemara explained why Rav Chisda was hesitant to adopting Rav Nosson's approach by refusing to title the small amount that he did take off as a tithe as being considered truma. And again, the reason for that is Dilma, we're afraid of the posha velo mafresh. He might be negligent, feeling a sense of comfort, and rationalize and say, well, that which I took off was considered truma anyway, so why should I have to do it again? Before we continue in the Gemara, we glance at the side under the Mivneh. We have a structural note. The diamonds that you see are a sidra, a series, shokushios of questions, li'or ha'mokur shuva li'el binyan ha'frosha min atome ala torbi. In light of the source we just read, we're now going to raise questions from other sources on this source. So the Gemara continues with a question. My shna meha disnan. What is different here from that which is taught elsewhere? Hatorim kishus venimsis mora. Kishus is a type of vegetation. As far as the literal translation of that, it's not important for us. All you have to realize, it's a type of vegetation that in its development, it could turn out to be bitter. In other words, by looking at it, you wouldn't be able to distinguish whether it's a bitter one or not. However, upon taste, you can tell there's a difference. So if someone was tithing from kishus, and the amount that he separated turned out to be bitter, avatiach v'nimsei soruach, or he was tithing avatichim, another kind of vegetation, and he tithed it, and upon cutting open the tithed produce, he finds it is soruach. It's rancid, it's decayed. Truma v'yachzor v'yitrom. What he has done is considered a tithe, but he's got to do it again. So the Gemara feels we should parallel the situation of it turning out to be bitter to the situation of it turning out to be defiled. In this case, there's no reference to the expression of lo'os of lo'klum. In other words, in this, according to this source, it's considered a truma, and he simply has to do it again. So why is that so over here? In the case before, we saw lo'os of lo'klum, he's done nothing. The Gemara responds, shogeg, amazed, karamis. Are you trying to raise a question from a scenario where something was done unwittingly, without any wrongful intention? Namely, the case we just read where it said v'nimseis moro, or nimseis, or it turned out to be. There was no intention for that to be the tithe. It turned out to be bitter or decayed. How can you raise a question like from a case of shogeg on the case of someone who was torein from the tome on the tohor to from the defiled on that which was undefiled, which was a case where there was premeditated intent? It said there b'mezid lo asav alukum. Mezid means with intention, wrongful intention. So how can you raise a question from a case, a scenario which was shogeg, on a scenario which was mezid? Shogeg lo avad isur, in the case where someone did something unintentional, there was no isur, no violation that was done. He was, as we said before, on a Torah level, if the tithe turns out to be, if the tithe is something that's not desirable, it nevertheless is a good tithe. It's considered a tithing. So on the shogeg level, it certainly is considered truma. So And that is a function of its low avad isur. It didn't do anything with wrongful intention. Mazid kavad isur. But in the case of mazid, where he intentionally tried to cause a loss to the kohen by using defiled produce, so he's done something wrong. So what the Gemara has shown is that there was no real question at the outset. All right, that having been said, there's another question though. V'rami shogeg ha-shogeg. Let us raise a seeming contradiction within the realm of the unintended. Hacha katoni b'shogeg trumasoi truma. In the case of tithing min ha-tomei al-ator, the source declared that the tithing is okay. He tithed from the defiled to exempt the pure, undefiled stuff. The source ruled that's okay then. Doesn't seem that it has to do anything else. Even though something wrong is the result, but it was without any intent. And Hasam Katoni, in the case of the Kishus turning out to be bitter, or the Avatiyah turning out to be decayed, Katoni, it says Truma V'Aser V'Yitrom. It says, it's considered a tithe, but he has to do it again. So why, in our case, the Tomei Alator, he doesn't have to do it again, and in the Nimsei Smora, he has to do it again? The Gemara answers, Hasam Shogeg Koroiv Lemezid. In the case of the vegetation that was tithed turning out to be bitter, it's true he did it without intent, but it was korov, it's close to being intentional, in the sense that it's there was lack of responsibility in his behavior. He was negligent. The Iboya le limitame. He should have, here we'll first give a literal translation, he first should have tasted it. Tosfos adds, well, how can you taste something that's untied? It's forbidden to eat even a morsel of something that's been untied. So Tosfos recommends that this fellow should have removed a negligible amount of the section he wanted to tithe from, and then do an internal tithing from the negligible amount, and then taste the balance of that negligible amount, and if it would turn out to be bitter, he would know, don't tithe from over here. So his not having done that, his not having been mitame, tasting it, is considered negligent on his part. And that's why we say you've got to tithe again from the good stuff. V'rami mezid amezid. Let us raise a seeming contradiction on the mezid level of things, the intentional level. Hacha katani b'mezid lo osa klum. You can see in the source above, in the halfway down the page, there's a little star to the side of the Gemara text. You can align the star and see where that's from. It said, well, if it was done intentionally, nothing has been done. Hasam tanan hatorim mishain nokuv al nokuv. In the source, in another Tanaic source, I should say, it mentions one who tithes from an otzitz is a flower pot. That's in the word otzitz you don't see in the source, but ein nokuv means it has no hole in the bottom. Something that doesn't have a hole, a drain hole in it, a hole of a certain minimum size. If it doesn't have that hole, it's considered on a Torah level exempt from tithing. No need to tithe. What is described there is someone removed a tithe from an ein nokuv. Nokuv is a hole, from a non-holed flower pot with the vegetation growing in it, to exempt al nokuv, to exempt that which grew in a pot with a hole in it, which does require tithing by letter of the law. So he did something wrong. He took from that which is exempt to exempt that which needs tithing. So the source says, Truma, V'Aser V'Yitrom. So we see, what do we see? We see two situations where there's an element of intent to do something wrong. In our case of the Tomei Tohor, he intended to remove from the Tomei a section to exempt the Tohor. We say that he's done nothing. In the case of the two separate flower pots, the source says he's got to do it again. The Gemara answers, why is there this discrepancy? Betray money tzayas. Tzayas means he will listen to you, he will heed you. In the case of the two separate types of flower pots, they were growing in, as we said, two separate vessels. When we tell the fellow, you know, you've got to tithe again, he will listen to us, he will heed our words and tithe again from the nokuv to exempt it. However, where two things grew in the same pot, as was the case where he was tithing from the tomei on the tor, whereas after he harvested the stuff from the same section, from the same pot, some of it became defiled, some was undefiled, and he removed from the defiled to exempt the undefiled. That's what the Gemara here means, b'chad mona, in one vessel, where they grew initially in the same vessel. If we were to tell him, you know, what you've done is a tithe, but you've got to do it again, he won't listen. So in order to motivate him to tithe again, we tell him what you've done is nothing. Oh, so they'll hear him. What he's done is nothing, so he'll then do the necessary tithing from the Tohor stuff. The Gemara continues with a need for further clarification. L'Rav Noson Rabbi Yeshaya D'yomar lo osav lo klum L'saken shirayim Avol Trumo Havi. According to the approach taken above, you can see we had his name underlined above, and we have a little arrow to the left hand side of the Moral text. You can align this with the arrow above where he appeared initially, where Nosson Rabbi Yoshia said that when you tithed from the Tomei on the Tohor, the source which had said if done intentionally Lo'osav L'klum meant that it's ineffective in remedying and exempting the Tohor section. However, the tithe that you did remove and declared as Truma is Truma. So according to his approach, the Gemara continues, my Shna, and here you could see at the top of Omid Beis, you see the diamond. It's another question in our series of questions. My Shna Mehadisnan, what is different from that which is taught in the following source? Min ha-nokuv al she'ein nokuv. Again, here's something that was done wrongfully. He tithed from the nokuv. The nokuv is the flower pot with the hole in it, and we said a moment before, this is a method of growth that needs tithing. But he tithed from that al she'ein nokuv to exempt the unholed flower pot, the growth, the vegetation that grew in the unholed flower pot. We say as follows, Trumoso Truma, the declaration that he made on the tithe section is Truma, simply because he declared it as Truma, even though it didn't need to be done. In other words, what he did was a wrongful action. He tried to exempt something that doesn't need exemption, something's exempted in the first place. So what he removed from the nokuv and declares truma, we say it is truma, veloi toichal ad sheyotzi oleo truma meiser mimokom acher. The section that he removed shall not be eaten. That which he declared from the nokuv, and we said the produce growing in the nokuv needs to be tithed. So we say as follows, the term or the title Truma attaches to it. However, bear in mind it was tithed to exempt something else. So in it in and of itself, being that it grew from an enokuv situation, it itself needs to be tithed. And simply by declaring a truma to exempt something else, that's not effective to remedy itself. So hence the source says, one shall not eat from it. Until the necessary tithes are removed on its behalf from some other place. What we've done marking wise, you can see we dashed underlined below tochal means we are considering it tevel gomor. We're considering it full fledged untithed stuff. Now, full fledged untithed stuff would mean that you wouldn't be able to even use it as fuel, even if it were, let's say, tomei. Let's take a look at Rashi at the top. In the case of the fellow tithing from the hold to exempt the unhold, so the source taught us that the Kohen shall not eat from it until tithes are removed to exempt it, as we grant it the status of complete tevel. That tevel is that which is untithed. Fakan kemokain lohoya litain la kohen. In our case of tithing from the tome to exempt the Torah, we shouldn't have given it to the kohen. After all, Reb Nosson seemed to say that it's truma, in itself is truma, but he has to tithe again. But by saying it itself is truma, you're basically saying, this is truma tamea, give it to the kohen, and a kohen who receives truma tamea will use it as fuel. Well, according to the source that we just read, min anokuv al she'ein nokuv, where we say it's viewed as tevel gomor, by giving this tamei tithe to the kohen, he might use it as fuel. And what you'll in effect be doing is burning tevel tamei. You're not allowed to do that. As the Gemara and Shabbos points out. So we have our question. We're waiting for the answer. Shiny hacha. The case of tithing from tomei on tohor is different. The midoraisa truma ma'al yisahi. On a Torah level, it's considered full fledged truma. It's a full-fledged tithe. In contrast to the case of tithing from nokuv on ein nokuv, when you're tithing from the nokuv to exempt the ein nokuv doesn't have any truma requirement to begin with on a Torah level. So that my declaration of the section removed as truma is zero on a Torah level. Not so, we're just repeating ourselves, not so in the case of tithing from the tomei to exempt the Torah. Oh, take note, by the way, that this is a long answer. When you're exempting the Torah by removing as a tithe from Tomei, on a Torah level, it's a legitimate tithing. Kidder Rebbe Eloi, based on Rebbe Eloi's teaching. The Yom Rebbe Eloi, Minayin L'Torah Min Ro Ala Yofet. From where do we know that one who tithes from the bad on the good, to exempt the good, but you are taking off the negative, the bad, that it's a good tithing. Dichtiv, the Pasuk says that the Pasuk exhorts landowners, when they tithe, do so in such a way that you shouldn't bear a sin. V'lo sisu lov chet v'amrim chem es chelboi mimenu. Do not bear a sin when you are tithing. The expression v'amrim chem es chelboi mimenu is a term referring to the tithing process. Technically speaking, chelbo has to do with fats. That's a literal translation. It means the high quality stuff. So you can understand this pasuk to tell me that if you remove as your tithe high quality produce to exempt the rest, so you will thereby be avoiding sin. The Gemara and Rebbe Eloi points out, v'im ein kadosh, if nothing has happened, if you say that when you're tithing from the raw aliyah and nothing has happened, if it's nothing, it's not kadosh, it's not sanctified, it's a zero, nesius chet loma, why is there any bearing of a sin for doing nothing? Mikan, from here, from the fact that the Pasuk says that there would be sin if you tithe from the ra'ah, from the negative on to exempt the positive, Mikan, from here we see, l'tarimina ra'ah yafesh shetrumasa truma, that it actually takes hold, it's considered effective, but something wrong has been done. So that's the proof. And hence, with that in mind, we understand the difference. In the case, just to repeat the sukya here, in the case of minanokuv al sheinokuv, the source indicates that it's considered tevel gomer, nothing has happened. Well, the reason for that is because on a Torah level, there was no need for tithing to begin with. Not so in the case of when you're tithing from Tomei to exemptar on a Torah level, as we just saw in the name of Reb Eloi, that's considered a legitimate or an effective tithing. I don't want to say it's a good tithing because something wrong was done, but it's considered something that it's a legal reality. And as a result of that, we can't avoid labeling it as truma. It is truma, and as Rav Nosson said, it's truma, but he has to tithe again. Now, as we continue in the Gemara, we glance at the side. It's true that structurally, the Gemara simply flows on. But it should be noted that we're really lapsing into a new discussion. Interestingly, the Gemara, the last question was focused on Rav Nosson Rav Oshia, who was the Bar Plukta of Rav Chisda. Here we're now going to focus our discussion on Rav Chisda. So, in marking wise, in order to indicate that there's a sort of a break in the flow, when we're now turning to a new topic, so we are suggesting the use of a semicolon at the end of the line, creating the feeling that we're now going into something that's new. So, on the side of the Gemara, we have a nosei klali, a general topic heading. And we also indicate that it's a very long discussion. It lasts till Daf Dalid Omid Beis. That is at Daf Tzadi Omid Beis. Correction, Daf Tzadi Omid Beis. Hence, we're calling this a general topic. And what we're describing this as Koyach LeBeisdin, the strength of Beisdin, Lakor Dover Minatora, to uproot something in the Torah. In other words, the Torah has declares A, and the rabbis come along, the Beis and the court comes along and declares B. You know, you're changing that which the Torah states, or the Torah rules. Now, in and of itself, a title like that sounds like something heretical. But as we go on in the Gemara, we'll discover more and more about this. Immediately, we have a marking that we want to take note of a nosei mivneh, a topic heading with a structural note, and also we indicate that this lasts till Tzadi Amid Beis. The triangle with the positioned upright represents a kushyas rabo l'Rav Chisda. So when you see an upright triangle in this discussion, it in effect represents rabo that we see here at the beginning of the discussion. Kushyas Rabbah Rav Chisda, Lefi Dvorecha, according to you, Rav Chisda, Ahodik Otoni Leon, Peites Omid Aleph, that which we saw on Omid Aleph, that Tori Mina Tomei Ala Tohor, Bemezid, Lo Osav Lo Klum, in that case where you did so intentionally, Hainu Kol Iker, you, Rav Chisda, said that means nothing has been done whatsoever. Even the section that he removed as a tithe reverts to Tevel. Lamrois, in spite of the fact, Shemidoraisa have truma. On a Torah level, it is truma. And you, Rav Chisda, are interpreting the Tanaic sources as to saying it's not. Do the sages have a power to come along and uproot something in the Torah? The Torah is saying that when you're mafrish minat tomei ala tor, it's considered truma. Comes along the sages and says loss of lokum, and according to your interpretation, it's nothing. It's as if nothing happened. It's tevel. So that represents Rabbah's question on Rav Chisda. How can you say loss of lokum kolik or nothing has happened when the Torah says it is a tithe? The inverted triangle in this ma'akav structure. Ma'akav was the word that we used at the beginning where the initial triangle appeared, where we're trying to keep track of the give and take style. The inverted triangle represents Tshuvas Rav Chisda, Rav Chisda's response. There are, as we said, it's a give and take style Gemara. Losim Leif, we have a note where we want you to pay attention, to take note, Hameshuloshim Hamemusporim. You will see numbered triangles. The numbering system runs down the side of the Gemara text. The numbered triangles, Haim Mekoros Shebohen Roim Beisin Okir Dovim Menatorah. These are Tanaic sources where the court does seem, in other words, there's precedent. There is precedent for this, so that if you, Rabbah, are wondering, hey, how could the court do this, as if my interpretation of loss of aloklum kolikar is wrong, what do you mean I'm wrong? Just because of your thought that how could it be? You see many Tanaic sources in which it does take place. So instead of asking on me, so to speak, why not ask on the sources? And you'll notice as we go down the Gemara, this numbering system lasts, it continues till Daf Tzadi Omid Bey, so that in the context of our Shir, our Daf Yomi structured Shir, we won't be able to complete this Sugya in this installment. But that having been said, you can see we have a general, very highly structured sugya ahead of us. Now, let's turn to the Gemara. We open with a question, it's a long question. Amale Rabo L'Rav Chisda. L'ditcha di Amris, according to you, that said on Omid Aleph, Lo Osov Lo Klum equals Kol Iker, that the Tanaic source, when he tithed from the defiled to exempt the undefiled, the source said nothing took place, and you added that meant at all. That even the small amount that he had declared as truma simply reverts to its untithed status. And why? Why so? My time, gzeira, dilma, posha, velo mafresh. All on the grounds that he would otherwise be negligent and not tithe again as we expect of him. So, mi iko midi, is there anything? Dimidoraisa have a truma, that on a Torah level, the tithe is considered a tithe. Namely, the tithing from the tome to exempt the tohor is a tithe. Umishum Duma Posha, and because of this consideration that, well, the owner might be negligent and not tithe again as we expect of him, Afkua Rabbanan Lechulin, the Besdin remove it. Afkua is literally to remove something, they take it out of its truma status and declare it null and void and have it revert to Chulin. Chulin is a term in this context in contrast to truma. It's considered mundane. Chulin is mundane, non-truma. V'chi Beisdin masnin lakor dovar min haTorah, can Beisdin impose conditions that in effect uproot that which is intended by the Torah? And that's what, according to you, Rav Chisda, that's what seems to be happening over here. The tithe that was done from the Tomei to exempt the Torah on the Torah level is considered a tithe, and you're coming and saying it's nothing. It's considered as if nothing happened, and that the amount that was separated itself is not even viewed as truma. Now, we'll say the music behind Rabbah's question is that such a thing is impossible. The rabbis could not uproot something from the Torah. Amar Lei, so Rav Chisda, in response to the, we'll say, the tone of Rabbah's question, so Rav Chisda says, V'at lo tisbra, and you don't agree, you don't hold that Basin can actually do something like that? V'hotanan. We have a Tanaic source, and this is our number one in the eventual seven sources which strengthen Rav Chisda's position that Beis Din can undo things. It said, and here is the tie-in, by the way, to our mission. If you remember, it's quite a while ago in today's shiur, we said that when we were beginning this, we called it the new sugya. There seemed to be no connection. Up till now, we've been dealing with a lot of laws concerning tithing, effectiveness or not effectiveness. What was the connection to our sugya? So here it is. Have we not learned in our Mishnah, Havlad Mamzer Mizo Mizeh? Our Mishnah described a woman who was married and received word through a witness, a singular witness, that her husband died. Well, she took that cue and married someone else. The original husband came back. And lo and behold, it turns out that her marriage to the second fellow was illegitimate. The Mishnah said that the children produced from both men at this point onwards, the children produced from both men, from the second husband and from the first husband from this point onwards, these are illegitimate children. Bishlam Amisheni, Mamzer, I understand children produced with the second man are illegitimate. Very simply, you have a woman that in truth is a married woman cohabiting with some other guy, and children born through relations like that are illegitimate. Ela me rishon amai. Why is the Mishnah declaring that the children that would be born from the, if she goes back to that first husband, that those children would be illegitimate? Ishtohi v'sro malyahu. The woman is his legal wife, and the child born from husband and wife are Yisrael Mal Yehu. The child is a fine, pure Jew. That's as far as the Torah is concerned. And yet the Mishnah declares that the child is illegitimate, and as a result of declaring him as illegitimate, because Sharinon Lei B'Mamzeres, you're entitling this child, that's a Yisrael Ma'aliyah, that's a fine, pure Jew, to marry as eventual his spouse would be a mamzeres, because by calling him a mamzer, the only people that a mamzer can marry, well, will include a mamzeres. A couple other examples, but they're limited. So you have an example of something that from the Torah has one intention, and the rabbis are coming and undoing it. Omale, Rabbah responds, don't bring that as a proof to your position. Rabbah is saying to Rav Chisda, Hachiyar Mar Shmuel. Shmuel interprets the Mishnah, our Mishnah, with the Mamzerim, Aser B'Mamzeres. He says that it's true that the child born from both of the men would be considered illegitimate, but the child born from the first husband is not allowed to marry a mamzeres. V'chein ki osa ravinam Rabbi Yochanan osur b'mamzeres. We're calling him a mamzer, but he's not allowed to marry a mamzeres. So we're not uprooting anything here. As far as your concern that we're allowing something that the Torah would not allow, not true. He's not allowed to marry a mamzeres. V'amai kori le mamzer. So then you'll ask, why are you calling him a mamzer? Answer, li oisroi Bevas Yisrael. We are preventing him from marrying a regular pure pedigree Jewess. Now Rashi explains the fact that we are prohibiting him is not called uprooting from the Torah, but rather it's a situation we call asiyas yog. It's building a fence where the Torah might have a might provide for a certain amount of leniency, and the Rabbanan move in and impose restriction. So the imposition of restriction is not considered uprooting something. It's simply considered adding power to the Torah's corpus of law. We continue with a question. Notice that we have a very long question ahead of us. Sholach le Rav Chisda le Rabo biyad Rav Acha bar Rav Huna. Now here you have to. It's important to note the direction of the triangle. We started off in the flow of the Gemara, Rabo challenging Rav Chisda, and hence we opened up with a triangle pointing up. Then we had Rav Chisda's response. That was the inverted triangle. And now we continue with an inverted triangle. Of course, we should point out we had Rav Chisda's response, but Rabo, we saw the triangle had repositioned itself pointing up, where Rabo had deflected Rav Chisda's point of defense. Now we have Rav Chisda taking the offensive, if you will, and hence we have now an inverted triangle. So that you can see how we have a back and forth style Gemara. The last speaker was Rabo, now Rav Chisda, but what we want to note is that Rav Chisda takes the offensive position. Sholach le Rav Chisda le Rabo. We read this already, but Rav Chisda sends to Rabo through an emissary, biad Rav Acha bar Rav Huna. V'ein besdin masnin la'akor dover min haTorah. You Rabo seem to be concerned with that happening. Well, there's precedent for that. V'hotanya me'emosai odom yoresh es ishto ketana. First, we translate. From what point in time does a man who's married to a minor, an ishto ketana? Ketana means she's a minor. From what point does he inherit her? Of course, she would have to die in order for him to inherit her. But there's more information that's missing. Now we need to add a word of background. From the Torah's standpoint, a father has the right to marry off his minor daughter to whomever he wants. If a father, let's say, we take the standard example, father dies, leaving a little girl. She's under 12 years old. But there's a mother and a brother in the family. The rabbis have a provision that she can be married to a man through them. They can offer her in marriage, but that's only rabbinic. From the Torah standpoint, a minor is eino bar das, doesn't have intent in their actions, and what a minor does then has no legal bearing, doesn't take hold legally. Rabbinically, though, in order to provide for a certain type of protection for young girls, if the father is dead, so it's probably to her benefit to be married to a man who will hope to protect her. So there's something called rabbinic marriage. Now we have a situation where the girl dies. And we're asking, in the event that she dies, from what point in time would the husband inherit her? So we continue reading. Beishamay omrim mishita mod bekoimasa. Rashi says mishita mod bekoimasa kishitagia lapirka bishonim ubavoa sear. If the girl had reached this age. Pirka is an age that most girls would experience puberty. That's a certain age. She's reached 12 years old, and she's brought forth pubic hairs. Ubeis Hillel omrim mishetikones lechupa. Beis Hillel says, from the point that she enters a marriage canopy. If she was not only betrothed, but entered the marriage canopy and then dies, the husband would be entitled to inherit her. Rabbi Eliezer Omer Mishetival, from the point of intimacy. V'yorsha umitamalo v'oicheles beginoi truma. There are 3 points. He is entitled to inherit her. If he's a Kohen, he's entitled to defile himself, to tend to her burial, participate in her funeral. And Ocheles Begino Truma, that she, if the rabbinic husband happens to be a Kohen, she'll be entitled in his merit of eating Truma. At this point, you can see we have a bracketed section. It's a lasts a number of lines. Use your bracket length indicator and skim down, and you see where it closes. Initially, let us skip this section. Kotoni Mihas, it however taught in this source, Yorsha. Now, the inverted triangle is explained on the side. The inverted triangle with the colored tip on the side of the Gemara. These are tzitutim. These are quotes. You can see the word Yorsha later, Metamela. These are quotes mehamokor meimosai odom from the source we just read. Shemochichim al kliach beis in lakor dovi min haTorah. These are proofs from the source itself that the rabbis have the power to uproot, to undo something that that the Torah would have provided for. So when we look at this, the source we just read, you see the husband inheriting her. So it said in this source, Kotoni Mihas Yorsha. Veha hacha dimidoraisa avua yorisla. On a Torah level, when this girl dies, the father's relatives inherit. The Torah spells out succession of inheritance. There's a certain inheritance hierarchy, if you will. And if the father, as we indicated before, was dead, so even though the Gemara says avuha yorsa, Rashi adds it's not literally avuha, but it's the relatives of the father. If the father died and the father has left the world with relatives, they would inherit her. And the Gemara continues, umi derabbanan yorisla, baal, on a rabbinic level, the husband is inheriting her. So what do we see? We see the power of the rabbis to take out of the hands of the father's relatives her estate and place it in the hands of this rabbinic husband. So Rav Chisda is showing, contrary to Rabba's thinking, that this does happen. Rabba answers, and hence we have a triangle with the tip facing up, Rabba's response. Hefker based in Hoyo Hefker. When it comes to monetary matters, the sages have power. That even I acknowledge. In other words, Rabba is saying, in other areas of halacha, so the rabbis can't come along and uproot something in the Torah, but when it comes to monetary matters, so there's actually scriptural reference to the rabbis having this power. It's within the realm of Torah law for the rabbis to come along and redirect possession of money. So even though the money, the estate, was destined to the father's surviving relatives, it's redirected through this entity, through this institution called Hefker Beis in Hoya Hefker. Sometimes it's stated in an abbreviated form, as they say Hefker Beis in Hefker. That entitles the rabbis to redirect money, to declare the money or possessions that were thought to be owned by A, and they declared it unowned by A and owned by B. That's Hefker Beis in Hefker. there appears another frame, another bracketed section. Within the brackets, the Gemara gives you all of the, gives you the sources. There are a couple of sources for that institution, for that power that the rabbis have, called Hefker Bezen Hefker. However, after the brackets, you see an inverted triangle. This is a reinstatement of a question that Rav Chisda is posing to Rabbo from the source. It said, Umetamala. We're skipping there. You could see the four lines from the bottom. Umetamala, the rabbinic husband, if he happens to be a Kohen, can defile himself to a woman that's not really his relative on a Torah level. If it was his Torah level wife, so the Torah provides for Kohanim, who generally speaking are restrained from defilement to the dead, but for seven close relatives, they're allowed to, they're expected to defile themselves. That's if they're really your relative, but here it's almost a fictitious relative. It's a rabbinic wife, and yet the Kohen is able to metame to her. The Gemara says, Timidoraisa via metamala on a Torah level, her father, if he was a Kohen, would be entitled to be metame to her. Umidirabonin metamala baal. And on a rabbinic level, we're allowing this man to this man, the husband, who's only related to rabbinically, not Torah level, we're allowing him to violate the rules of Tumas Kehanim. So you see from here that the court has that power. Rabba will answer. He answers, Mishum Dehavila Meis Mitzvah. She's considered a special category of dead that a Kohen is allowed to metame himself to, also sanctioned by the Torah, and that realm is called Meis Mitzvah. That's a body, a corpse, that otherwise would have no one to bury it. The Gemara is going to question, how can you describe this girl as a Meis Mitzvah? She has her family would bury her if this husband doesn't. The Gemara will say, not so, and we'll explain that later. If we skip momentarily to the top of Tzadi Omer Aleph, it says there, V'yoicheles beginoi truma. We're entitling this woman to eat truma. Now, she's not a... She's married to a Kohen, but only rabbinically. It's true that if it's a Torah-level marriage, a Kohen entitles his non-Kohen wife to eat from truma. That's true. But this Kohen is married to this girl only rabbinically. And it's said in the source, she's going to be eating from truma. How could that be? Unless you say that the rabbis have the power to uproot that which it says in the Torah. The Torah says that a non-Kohen is not allowed to eat truma, and the rabbis come and say that this non-Kohen, the girl, who's married to this Kohen rabbinically, is entitled to eat truma. So here you have again Rav Chisda making his point. Rabba answers, but truma derabbanan. You're dealing with a rabbinic level truma. That means it's a tithe that from the Torah's standpoint doesn't need to be tithed whatsoever. A non-Kohen certainly can eat from it. The rabbis imposed the need for tithing from this kind of produce. So the same rabbis who said that it needs to be tithed, those same rabbis, they make the rules. They can break the rules, so to speak, also. They say that someone who is rabbinically married to a Kohen is also entitled to eat from it. Eat from what? Eat from stuff that they themselves, the rabbis themselves, had created as truma. As you can see, when we reach Tzadi Omer Aleph at the top, you can see the discussion continues. That will be beyond the realm of our Daf Yomi schedule. But in the meantime, we go back to all of the sections of the Gemara that we skipped, and we did so with the intention of maintaining the flow of the Gemara, the back and flow, back and forth nature of the Rabbo Rav Chisda or Rav Chisda Rabbo discussion. That having been said, we go back to the first bracketed section, where we were coming on the heels of a source that spoke about a man that was rabbinically married to a minor. And Beis Shammai said in that source that from what point does he inherit her? From Mishitamo de Klimasa. So now we pick up the Gemara. We're back on Omid Beis. You can see a little more than halfway down the page. This is a in the bracketed section. The Gemara quotes from the source Beis Shammai Omri Mishitamoid Beklimasa. The Gemara asks, Afal Gav Deloy Nichnasa Lachupa. Even if there was no marriage canopy, even if she didn't enter the marriage canopy. So what are we taught? What are we describing? We're describing a man that offered marriage money. He betrothed this minor. And if she reaches the age of puberty and brings forth pubic hairs, so and then dies, he can inherit her. Is that so? Even if she didn't enter a marriage canopy, Rashi points out that in general, as far as the laws of husband inheriting from one's wife, even if this were a Torah level marriage, a husband does not inherit the betrothed level wife. He inherits only from the point that nisuin takes place, or entrance to a marriage canopy, a chuppah. So how can that be over here in the rabbinic style marriage that the husband would be inheriting her at a point in time where even on a Torah level he wouldn't be inheriting her? The Gemara answers, Amo, we should understand Beis Shammai as follows. Mishitamoid b'klimosa v'tikones l'chupa. Not only marriage canopy, but she would also have to have reached that age that we call tamoid b'klimosa. V'hochi ko'amri le Beis Shammai le Beis Hillel. And in the source, the give and take between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is to be understood as follows. You, Beis Hillel, said that it's enough that the girl, the minor, enters a marriage canopy, and that would be enough for upon her death the husband to then inherit her. We say, Beis Shammai, Iomda b'kaimasa mahanya lo chupa. If she reached the age of puberty, then the chuppah will have meaning. Mahanya means effective. It'll be effective, enabling the husband to inherit her. V'iloi, if she was not omda b'kaimasa, lo mahanya lo chuppah. The chuppah will not be effective. Contrary to what Beis Hillel was trying to reason, that chuppah is enough. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Mishetival, Rabbi says that for the husband to be able to inherit the wife, they would have had to have intimacy. Ve'omar Rabbi Lezer ain maisik tana klum. But Rabbi Lezer is on record as saying that the actions of a minor is of no significance. So what if he would have had intimacy with her? So the Gemara says we have to restate Rabbi Lezer. Emo mishetagdil v'tival. This husband will be able to inherit the woman that initially was married to her only rabbinically, only from the point that she reaches adulthood and has intimacy, and that would in effect consummate and concretize the marriage, and only then the husband would be able to inherit her. This we read already, but we'll read it again quickly. Kotoni mihas yarsha. It stated in the source that the husband will be inheriting her. Ha ha midaraisa vuli yaris on a Torah level, the father's family would inherit her. Umidra bonon yaris lo baal. And from the rabbinic standpoint, the husband is inheriting her. So we see from here that the courts, the rabbis, have the power to undo something provided for by the Torah. The Torah provided for the father's family inheriting the girl, and the rabbis are coming along and saying that this rabbinic husband is going to inherit her. So Rabbo answers, Hefker based in Hoyo Hefker. That which concerns monetary matters, there the Rabbonim have full reign over that. But as far as other areas, my initial claim, says Rabba to Rav Chisda, my initial claim stands that the basin can't undo things provided by provided for by the Torah. And now the bracketed section explains the source for that. Diomar Rabbi Yitzchak Minayin Shehefker Basin Hoyefker. From where do we know that that which the basin that the court declares unowned by Mr. 1 and now owned by Mr. 2, from where do we know they have that power? Shenemar, there is a pasuk. It says Kol Asher Loyov, and note this pasuk is from the book of Ezra. And Ezra had declared the following: Kol Asher Loyovo Lishloshes Hayomim Beatzas or Keatzas Hasorim Vazakenim. Anyone who doesn't come within 3 days, as the ministers and the elders ruled, Yochram Kol Ruchusho Vuyibodel Mikahal Hagola. All of his ruchush, all of his possessions, will be declared confiscated, and he will be separated from the rest of the congregation. We're not getting into the historic background to what was taking place over there. What we see from here, though, is simply the declaration of a person's property being confiscated, and that was within the powers granted to Ezra and the rabbinic court legal community. Rabbi Lozer Omar Mehocha. Rabbi Lozer offers a second source. Eile anachlois shenochlu elozer akain vishua binun v'roshe ha'avois lematois b'nei Yisrael. This is a pasuk dealing with the division of the land of Israel amongst the different tribes and different subdivisions. In this pasuk, it mentions that the ones responsible included Elozar HaKoyen, Yeshua Ben Nun, and the Roshe HaOvos Lamatas Ben Israel. V'chima inyan Roshim Eitzel Ovos. We have the leaders, and it mentions fathers. What are fathers doing in this pasuk? Elo Lomar Loch. Ma Ovos Manchim B'neim Kol Mashi Yirtzu. Just like a father within the context of his property and family, he can declare whatever property he wants to whichever children he wants. Af Roshim, so to the leaders of the Jewish people, so to the leaders, Manchilin Es Ha'om Kol Mashiyutu. They can bequeath upon any one of the people whatever they want. In other words, full rabbinic control over monetary matters. Rashi points out that if the pasuk was simply describing the historical events that took place, i.e. the division of the land, so the pasuk would have simply said the Roshei Matos Bnei Israel, but it sticks in the word Ovois, hence the basis of the drosha that we just read. We continue. Umitamala, in the original source, we saw amongst the different aspects of a rabbinic marriage, the husband who is a Kohen, if the husband is a Kohen, upon her death, he can defile himself, he can oversee her burial. From the Torah's perspective, her father, the father is the one that defiles himself to her. And on a rabbinic level, the husband is going to defile himself. Now, this man on a Torah level is not related to the woman. She's considered a rabbinic wife. But on a Torah level, this fellow happens to be a Kohen. A Kohen's not allowed to defile himself to the dead. And yet, this is Rav Chisda's point, and yet the rabbis are coming along and saying, and uprooting the Torah laws of ritual purity demanded of Kohanim. Rabba answers, Mishum dahavya lo meis mitzvah. This girl, who's rabbinically married to this Kohen, this girl, her corpse is categorized as a meis mitzvah. A meis mitzvah, without getting into the details of meis mitzvah, is simply the encounter with a body that has not been buried and no one else is going to take care of it. It's the simple case of a meis mitzvah, someone walking along a desolate road and noticing an unburied body. So he is to bury it, even if he happens to be a kohen, and not only that, even if he happens to be a kohen gadol, he buries the untended to body. So the girl is described as a meis mitzvah. The Gemara asks, "So mihava a meis mitzvah? Is this girl a meis mitzvah?" Tanya, we have the following source that describes that: a zehu meis mitzvah. What's a meis mitzvah? Called she'ein lo kovrin, any body that doesn't have anyone to bury it. If you would simply call out, "Hey, there's a body here," and others would come to bury it, that's so the body is not considered a meis mitzvah. Someone else will take care of it. The kohen doesn't have to defile himself. The goal is to see to it the proper honor due to a corpse. If others will bury it, that's sufficient. So this girl isn't just some body that's strewn at the side of a road and no one's around. And here the Gemara has a very dramatic response and says, in fact, over here, Kevon de lo Yarsin law, since the father's family is not going to be inheriting her, they have nothing to gain, so to speak, no money, no moolah to make out of this girl. Karya velo anulah. People might call out to the husband, let's say the kohen might call out to have them take care of her. They're not going to come. Now you see something here which might make some people uncomfortable, but the Torah is amazingly rooted in human reality. And when we speak about the Torah, especially the oral tradition, especially the Chazal, and we in Gemara, in our Gemara markings, Shiurim, in our recordings, we try to make this point from time to time how down to earth our sages are. And even though some people might be struck emotionally as being, how could that be? Well, just because of money, someone's going to leave the body there. When you get down into the depths of the human psyche, unless you rise above the simply base nature of human beings, unless you rise above that, you will find that it's all about money. That's a reality. We're not here. We're not saying what we're saying now as a point of criticism or making any value judgment about that. It's a reality. People have to come to terms with this, that it's all about money. And therefore, if people feel they have nothing to gain from someone, the level of interest they will have in that party is going to be limited. To this extent, and here, as I say, this is a very dramatic unmasking of a human, maybe a human foible or a human circumstance, that since her family isn't going to be gaining from her, they're not going to take the slightest bit of interest in burying her. Again, they say, wow, how could that be? Many of you are emotionally healthy individuals, and that rubs you the wrong way. But as we said, this reality must be taken into consideration. Even if it isn't the majority of cases, but it is present. And many of us know examples where if I have nothing to gain from it, then I have no interest in it. By the way, this concept can be expanded quite a bit to entire concepts of economic systems, and in rather recent history, we know of certain societies that failed, and it could very well be that it's rooted in this, that if you don't give people sufficient monetary financial incentive, it's just not going to work. Even with all the proper, or even with all the high-level philosophical intentions that might have, and some famous authors and philosophers may have constructed, It's all about money. And this is, in fact, reflected in a very famous Drushas Chazal, V'yohavtes Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol ma'idecha. And the Chazal ask if what do these words mean? B'chol nafshecha, you must love God even if it is at the supreme sacrifice of one's life. And u'b'chol ma'idecha, what does that mean? If it means at the that your expression of love of Hashem is going to come at the expense of your financial holdings, you must forego your financial holdings. But now, when you look at that particular drusha, you ask, once you're told that you have to give up your life for, if necessary, as a demonstration of your allegiance to the Almighty, so of course you're going to give up your money. So the Chazal revealed to us in that drusha, which is part of the Kriya Shema that we say several times every single day, that there are people that love their money, their possessions, more than their own life. And people like that, in order to express the ultimate in allegiance to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so you have to sacrifice that which is the ultimate. For some people it's their own lives, but for some people it's their money. So that having been said, this drasha should not come as a shock. And hence, this girl, who's rabbinically married to the husband, and as we saw, he is going to, through Hefker, Besk, and Hefker, he is going to be inheriting her. He's the one that's going to be experiencing the financial benefits from her, and not her own family. She's declared a meis mitzvah. She would be left unburied otherwise. Hence, the husband has to take care of her, even if he happens to be a kohen. And we continue at the top of Tzadi Omer Aleph with the last quote from that source, the inverted triangle where Rabbah Rav Chisda is attacking Rabbah. He says, well, here you see Bezin being Oker Dovim in HaTorah. It says, V'yocheles Begino Truma. She is rabbinically married to a Kohen, so on a Torah level, she's not entitled to eat Truma. And yet, because of this rabbinic marriage, to a Kohen, he is enabling her to eat Truma. How can that be? Is that not an uprooting where the Torah says to the woman, do not eat truma? And the rabbis are saying, you can eat truma. Here the rabbis are uprooting something in the Torah. So Rav Chisda, Rabbah responds and says, that doesn't show the power of the Rabbanah to uproot something from the Torah, because in the source we're not dealing with anything from the Torah. But truma, the Rabbanan, we're dealing with produce whose initial need for tithing is only rabbinic. The Torah says only specific types of produce are to be tithed. The common example of that is dogon tirosh and yitzar, grains, olive oil, and wine. And the rabbis say that oranges and tomatoes and cucumbers also need to be tithed. So from the Torah perspective, she is eating something that the Torah doesn't prevent her from eating in the first place. As you can see, marking wise, Rav Chisda continues with his, attacks on Rabbah, where he demonstrates from additional sources that the rabbis do seem to have the power to uproot something from the Torah, and we will be awaiting the responses of Rabbah, where Rabbah indicated, oh, that can't be. So why in these sources do we say that it can happen? So Mirtz Hashem, stay tuned to our next shiur for the further continuation of this sugya. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked Gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.